Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce Andrea Husby, our speaker. She studied at the University of San Francisco, where she received her BA and MA in English Lit. While living in Paris and The Hague, she studied fine arts. Dr. Husby received an MA in art history from Hunter College in New York and a PhD in art history from the Graduate Center of City University of New York. Since returning to California, she has taught art history at Pacific Union College and Santa Rosa Junior College and has served as a guest curator at Napa Valley Museum, where she was trustee from 2003 to 2008. She is a docent here in town, and she also teaches at the Fromm Institute, which I think some of you who are here in the audience are well aware of. So welcome, please welcome with me Professor Husby. Thank you very much. Yeah.
We need to dim
the okay.
Lights.
You can dim the lights maybe for the...
Or turn them off.
Well, yeah. This light up here stays on.
Great. Oh, that's good.
How's that?
That's perfect.
Great.
And I need to speak into this, right? Can that be turned off or... No, that doesn't turn off? Okay. So he's telling me no, it doesn't turn off. So there are some other seats if it's... Okay. So I was fine until those three. So I would like to welcome you to the Humanities West program as well, the Florence of the Medici. Tonight's topic is going to be Artemisia Gentileschi, an artist who benefited greatly from the patronage of the de' Medici at a crucial period in her life. Turn the sound up a little bit. Can somebody do? Yeah. Is that better? Is this better? Oh, maybe I just need to move in closer. Does that help? Okay, there we go. Thank you. The two images that you're looking at, one is self-portrait as martyr, the other is St. Catherine of Alexandria. Just as controversy shaped the reception of her work during her own lifetime, it continues to shape the current assessment of Artemisia Gentileschi's work in ours. The two images that you're looking at, the one on your right, the earlier of the two, is a small oil on board and was a study for the larger work of St. Catherine of Alexandria. And both works are indicative of the challenges that scholars face in addressing Artemisia's life and work, which is probably best known to the public as the subject of three novels, a documentary, and a movie. Unfortunately, many of these have been inaccurate or incomplete in the information that they have given. Both of these works have only recently been attributed to Artemisia. Both are believed to be self-portraits based on physical characteristics, specifically the shape of the eye and mouth, as well as the dimpled hand, which you can see right here especially. And both are now believed to be dated to the 7 or 8 years that she spent in Florence, that is, between 1613 and 20, when these rich and brilliant costumes that both of these are wearing began to make their appearance in her work. Although a consensus is emerging on Artemisia's work, there remain several major issues that have not yet been resolved, and specifically in the areas of attribution and dating. The picture changes under constant revision. One of the major factors for this state of affairs is that Artemisia, like many of her contemporaries, that is, other minor artists and especially female artists, were left out of the writing of the history of art at the Baroque, during the Baroque in Italy, that is, the 16th and 17th century, when scholars were focusing on the great masters of that style, Bernini, Rubens, Rembrandt, and Caravaggio, who, uh, who figures into Artemisia's work. You're looking tarnished by scandal and hindered by a society that expected to be women to be either nuns or wives. Artemisia Gentileschi nevertheless became the most accomplished female painter of her time. She was, according to the inscription, at the bottom of this engraving after a self-portrait of hers commemorating her membership in the Venetian Academy, a, quote, miracle in painting, more easily envied than imitated. In spite of this celebrity, Artemisia has suffered from a scholarly neglect that is almost unimaginable in an artist of her caliber. In fact, it's not until the early 20th century when the art historian Roberto Longhi, pursuing his own work on Artemisia's father, Orazio, came across Artemisia and wrote a landmark essay on both father and daughter. It took almost 40 more years for another art historian to begin to address her work, R. Ward Beazle, who also, following up on his own dissertation on Orazio, began to address the work of his of Artemisia. Oh, wait, I have to do this. Okay. Current rediscovery of Artemisia began in earnest with the question posed by American art historian Linda Nochlin in her seminal essay for Art News in 1971, when she asked, why have there been no great women artists? 5 years later, Nochlin answered her own, Nochlin, along with art historian Anne Sutherland Harris, answered her own question in the groundbreaking exhibition Women Artists 1550 to 1950, which was organized by the LA County Museum of Art. With the aim of providing a fuller and richer picture of the history of art, these authors rediscovered the lives and work of dozens of women artists who had well-deserved reputations in their own lifetimes, but remained obscured in ours. One of the artists who was influenced by this groundbreaking exhibition was Judy Chicago, an American artist and leader of the feminist movement. She was inspired not only by the question that Nochlin posed, but also the creative challenge that the answer implied. Her dinner party, which you see here, is a mixed-media installation composed of a large triangular table, each side 48 feet long, and it honors 1,038 women. 99 names are inscribed on the heritage floor, which is very difficult for you to see. It often appears as if that's like water or just tiles. But in fact, it's tiles, and on each tile are inscribed the names of 999 women. And then on either side of the triangle, 39 women were honored through place settings, meant to the whole arrangement of which was meant to evoke the Last Supper. In the second section of the banquet table, that would be this section along here, is a place setting for Artemisia Gentileschi among other women artists of the 17th century. I don't know how well you can see some of these names from where you're sitting, but embroidered on the cloth of honor are other names that were also explored in this groundbreaking exhibition. Some you may know, the Dutch artist Judith Leister, both French artists Angelica Kaufman and Elizabeth Vrigier-Lebrun. Others remain relatively unknown and little understood even today. And these include Artemisia's closest contemporary Italian women artists, Sofonisba Anguissola, Rosabella Carrara, and particularly Lavina Fortuna, all contemporaries of Artemisia. Among these women, Artemisia had perhaps the most successful career, which spanned almost 40 years. Each place setting, this is Artemisia's place setting here, is personalized to convey the most characteristic elements, information and elements about the honoree. The details of Artemisia's setting all relate to her Florentine period. And I'm not sure how well you can see. I'm going to be speaking here about her name. The sword that you see is a reference to the biblical figure Judith, a major theme in her work, again, especially during the Florentine period. The first letter in her name is illuminated with an artist's paintbrush and palette, representing her life as an artist, and it is believed that she was the first woman artist to support herself and her family solely by her artwork. Surrounded by luscious velvet fabric, referring to the elaborate costumes of Ginoleschi's female subjects found in her Florentine period. The particular gold is a reference to a color in her paintings, which we'll be looking at, and became known as Artemisia gold. This important exhibition, the Nocklin exhibition, also inspired a breakthrough in scholarship concerning Artemisia. And this breakthrough came in 1989 with the publication of Mary Gerard's book, Artemisia Ginoleschi, The Image of the Female Hero in Italian Baroque Art. Gerard's monograph was followed in 1999 by Beazel's catalog Resiné that surveyed the works then known and attributed to Artemisia. Since then, Artemisia has become a magnet for the exercise of almost every form of new art history. The results have been mixed and at times contradictory. More recently, art historians have begun to focus on balancing the often conflicting and dramatic biographical information of Artemisia's life with an assessment of the strength of her contribution as an artist, not a female artist, but an artist, to the history of European art. I'm showing you Susanna and the Elders from 1610. It's probably one of Artemisia's best known works. It is, and again, I'm not sure, I feel sort of trapped in here. I'm going to step away from them. Oh, I can't do that because they won't be able to hear it. On the second, it is signed and dated on the second right here. Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you. That's better. It is signed and dated. It doesn't really show up here, but it is right here. Artemisia Ginoleschi, 1610. Artemisia was born in 1593 to Orazio Ginoleschi, who himself was born, not Ginoleschi, but Orazio Lomi in Pisa in 1563, the son of a Florentine goldsmith. He assumed the name Ginoleschi when he moved to Rome to stay with his uncle. Although Orazio is now recognized as a major figure amongst the Baroque artists, his career was in fact quite slow in getting started. And it was not until the first decade of the 17th century, at almost 40 years old, that he met and was influenced by Caravaggio. This brought about a dramatic change in his style. By 1610, he was part of a group of artists adopting the dramatic theatrical compositions and tenebrisms of Caravaggio. Orazio was a sole parent, Artemisia's mother Perdicia having died in 1605. She was one of four children left behind. It is believed that Artemisia began her training as an artist around 1608 or 9, which would have been quite common at this period for women artists to train with their fathers, since they were denied access to any other training. They were not allowed in the academies, and even the idea of going to another artist's studio to be trained would have been frowned on because of social limitations. The subject that we see here is based on the Old Testament story that tells of Susanna, the beautiful wife of an elder Israelite tribe who is seen and desired by two other elders who frequently spy on her at her house. One day, as Susanna decides to take a bath in her garden, she sends her servants out to fetch oil. When they leave, the two elders approach Susanna, demand sexual favors, and threaten to declare that they had seen her with a young lover if she refuses them. The work is a stunning achievement for a student of Artemisia's age and inexperience. It offers a rarely seen emotional understanding of the psychological plight that we see here of on the face of the female figure as this sexual intimidation and blackmail occurs. The scene that, which is the scene being depicted, the confrontation of the two elders and Susanna, who is virtuous, and being virtuous and courageous, she refuses them. They fulfill their threat and falsely accuse her, but Susanna is later saved by a young man named Daniel, who, while interrogating the two elders, catches them in their lies. The painting confronts us with an unusually accomplished technical performance by an artist who, in 1610, had, according to her father's own account, only been painting for a year or two. Because of this, and because of documents available to him at the time, which indicated that Artemisia's birth date was 1597, not 1593, Roberto Longhi, despite the signature and dating that is apparent on the canvas, attributed the painting to her father, Orazio. This, too, was a common practice among artists of the period, and by art historians who have been examining this period frequently, when the daughter's paintings are not actually attributed to the daughter. And this is a mistake that is actually kind of reasonable when you consider that it's in this early period that these daughters are most under the influence of their father's work. So they are most likely to have common traits and characteristics. It was only later that Beisel discovered documentation proving that Artemisia was born in 1593, and a reassessment of the attribution to Artemisia followed. It is now widely accepted as an early work by Artemisia, but one in which Orazio helped his daughter pupil in the planning and execution of the work. His degree of involvement in the work, however, is still very controversial. Less than 6 months after the completion of this work, in May 1611, Artemisia was raped by Agostino Tassi, a friend of her father's and fellow artist. This tragic event has become the defining moment in Artemisia's life and a prism through which most of her work has been interpreted. According to court documents of the sensational trial, which Orazio initiated almost a year after Tazio's initial attack, Tazi raped the 18-year-old girl, continued a relationship with her for many months on the promise of marriage, withdrew that promise of marriage, failed to pay the customary dowry due a father of a daughter who had lost her virginity under such extreme circumstances, and just to make matters, to put the final capping, had taken away from Ginoleschi's house a painting, a large painting, with the subject Judith. Both Tassi and Artemisia were submitted to torture, apparently the preferred method of fact-checking at the period. Both stuck to their respective stories, and eventually Tassi was convicted and exiled from Rome, although, again, records indicate that he lived there for quite a long period afterward, quite openly. Instead, it was Artemisia who was effectively exiled from her home. No doubt realizing that the scandal of the trial itself, regardless of its outcome, would make it all but impossible for Artemisia to live and work in Rome, It appears that Orazio devised a plan for Artemisia to seek refuge in Florence, where several members of the Lomi family still lived. And in July 1612, he wrote a letter to Maria Cristina, the Dowager Grand Duchess of Tuscany, and mother of Cosimo Due, begging her help in blocking attempts to secure Tassi's release from prison, and offering, by the way, to send her a painting by Artemisia, by way of introducing her to possible Medici patronage. The trial ended in October 1612, and in November, Artemisia quickly married a Florentine painter, Pietro Stiazzi, who had testified in her favor during the trial. The newlyweds moved to Florence, perhaps as early as the beginning of 1613, although this date, as so many dates dealing with the life and work of Artemisia, is not fixed. We do have a record of the baptismal of her first daughter in July 1613 in Florence, so we know that she was there at least by then. Artemisia would give birth to four children in the 7 or 8 years that she was in Florence. Three sons died in infancy, but the daughter Prudencia lived to adulthood. A second daughter, Francesca, was born after leaving Florence. And I'm showing you here a painting by Justus Susterman of Cosimo Due II, his wife, Maria Magdalena of Austria, and their son. It was during the years spent in Florence that Artemisia produced several of her most important works. While Michelangelo Buonarroti, the younger, who was the grandnephew of the famed artist, commissioned a fresco, the Allegory of Inclination, in 1615, for the ceiling of the library of the Casa Buonarroti, it is without doubt that Cosimo Due was Artemisia's major patron, and at least 7 of the 10 known works from this period were painted for Cosimo. There's Cosimo and Cristina's court. Was a young and vibrant court that enjoyed their wealth with grand displays of extravagance, including much pageantry performances and lavish costumes. The relationship with Medici came at a critical period in Artemisia's life and career. And we will see that it is in her Florentine period really does fulfill the promise of her earlier work. I'm showing you two works, both on the same subject, the subject being Mary Magdalene. And both of these works were believed commissioned by Cosimo or his wife, the Grand Duchess Maria Magdalena, to honor the patron saint of this deeply religious woman. Again, the subject matter is the New Testament harlot Mary Magdalene, who becomes a disciple of Christ. It was a popular subject in the 16th and 17th century, and a wide variety of depictions of the saint exist. Focusing first on the earlier of the two works, The Penitent Magdalene, it is unsigned and undated, and only very recently attributed to Artemisia, and again is an example of the continuing work that scholars are doing in trying to establish a firm record of her work. It is also the most contentious of the two, the more contentious of the two works I'm showing you. We see the saint holding a skull right here, and it is a vanitas painting, a reminder of man's mortality. It references to a more common image of the saint in a state of despair and soul-searching, accompanied by wringing of hands and the appearance of trembling. The conversion of the Magdalene, which I'm showing you here at later, dated 16 to 20, is one of the high points of Artemisia's Florentine years and reveals a much more innovative composition. It is accepted by all scholars and is one of 19 of her 48 known extant works that is signed. Here, she has signed, that you probably can't see this because of the resolution on the screen, but it is actually signed here in gold lettering along the edge of the chair on which the Magdalene sits. It is Sign Artemisia Lomi, her father's family name, which she used in Florence, to both distance herself from the recent Roman scandal as well as to highlight her familiar connections to the city. Although the dates on this painting have fluctuated between 5 to 10 years, consensus does exist that it was, in fact, produced during her Florentine period. We see the figure draped in rich fabric, possibly silk velour, which marks her privileged status. It may also be a possible reference to the fortune that the Medici made in the textile trade when Florence was one of the greatest of the great centers in Europe for textile production. In her composition, Artemisia has struck a balance between depicting the saint's virtue, which allowed her to renounce her sin her life of sin, and her sensuality, which led her there. And it is very subtly maintained, not only in the figure of the saint, but also in the setting. Here we see that I'm not sure of the resolution that you're seeing, but on the table right here where she is resting her hand, there is a jar, her attribute, and the sign by which she is known, referring to her washing of Christ's feet, the ultimate act of humility. She's pushing away a mirror, a symbol of vanity, which also reflects some of the jewelry that she is wearing, another symbol of vanity. She herself is also a balance. We have her slightly disheveled appearance, hair, with her gown slipping over one shoulder, which conveys here a sensuality, while her upward gazing eyes and hand to her breast over her heart indicate the sincerity of this deeply felt spiritual conversion. The lavishness of the gold dress and gown that she wears is set off by the placement of the bare foot, which is cut off on the screen here, but we could see her bare foot, a symbol of absolute humility and holiness. The gold dress is an indication of Artemisia's adoption of Florentine interest in material richness and is also evidenced by the additionally by the brilliant color and dazzling technique in her treatment of it. Again, this is exactly why this color gold finally was referred to as Artemisia gold. In this composition, Artemisia has masterfully depicted the moment of renunciation of the saint for her former life of pleasure for the life everlasting in the Christ. The importance of the Florentine years for Artemisia, however, was not based solely in terms of her work. More importantly, perhaps, is the new level of literacy and education that she achieved. At the trial in 1612, Artemisia had stated that she could neither read nor write. It was at the court of the Medici that she learned to do both. And this is especially exemplified by her exchange of letters with none other than Galileo Galilei, the most learned man of his day. He may have known Artemisia's father or been introduced to him previously. And he and the young woman, Artemisia, struck up a quite odd but lasting relationship. Her other associations with other members of the Medici court included illustrious Florentine philosophers, painters, sculptors, and artists, as well as those from other fields, such as Francesca Caccini, the renowned female composer and musician. In terms of her career, Cosimo's influence that Artemisia became the first woman to be accepted into the Florence Academy, and this had a profound effect on the rest of her life. Academy members were free from guilds and family tutorage, For Artemisia, this meant freedom and autonomy from both her father and her husband. It also, in small ways, allowed her to acquire pigments without a male's permission. Previously, she would not have been able to do even that. Most importantly, however, it allowed her to sign contracts and travel on her own, allowing her to negotiate directly for commissions and later to leave Florence to pursue art in other cities and elsewhere, help paving the way for her acceptance in both the academies in Rome and Venice. I'm showing you here two of Artemisia's paintings, most famous paintings of Judith Slang Holofernes, the first from 1612-13, the later from about 1620. The dates for both of these paintings are continually undergoing revision, but they're felt to be fairly secure for now. This particular subject brackets the years of Artemisia's Florentine career and is evidences her originality in conception that challenges traditional representations of popular baroque depictions of courage and physical prowess. The earlier painting, which I'll refer to as the Naples painting, maybe I'll refer to it as the painter in blue, with the blue dress, might be easier for you to remember. There is consensus forming that it was either started in Rome just prior to her leaving finished in Florence. This painting, however, has been cut from the left side. How much cannot be determined. And the unintended end effect is to bring the viewer closer into the scene. The later version is signed, and again, this probably is not going to show up here, is signed along the blade right here. Again, Artemisia Lomi. And it is now believed to have been started under the patronage of the Medici and finished after she left for Florence. Again, the subject matter is drawn from a popular theme of the Old Testament, which relates the story of the slaughter of the Assyrian general Holofernes by the Jewish widow Judith. Judith goes to the enemy camp with her maid Abra, who we see here and here, with the intention of seducing and then decapitating Holofernes, gaining his trust by promising information to the Israelites. She is allowed access to his tent one night as he lies in a drunken stupor. She decapitates him, takes his head back to her fearful countrymen. The Assyrians, losing their leader, disperse, and Israel is saved. In the Renaissance and Baroque literature, painting, and sculpture, the story of Judith became an example of the courage of local people against tyrannical rule from afar. Artemisia would have been well aware that Judith held special meaning for Florence and for the Medici in particular. I'm showing you a slide of Donatello's sculpture, Judith and Holofernes. The statue was commissioned by the first Cosimo de' Medici, namesake of Cosimo Duo, as a decoration for the fountain in the garden of the Plaza Medici. Existing documents mention an inscription on a now lost pedestal which read, and I quote, "The salvation of the state, Piero della Medici, son of Cosimo, dedicated this statue of a woman both to liberty and to fortitude, whereby the citizens with unvanquished and constant heart might return to the Republic." The statue then functions as a metaphor of the Medici rule, as the defenders of Florentine liberty, akin to Judith, slayer of tyrants and defender of the people, and thus establishes a clear connection between Judith, Florence, and the Medici. If we can compare the two works briefly, we can see that there are major differences. Donatello, Renaissance artist, has chosen to depict the great moment of greatest anticipation immediately before the climax of the story, in which the Judith, on the other hand, has decided to take it to the climax of the story, and the assassination is taking place in front of our very eyes. The approach to the figure of Holofernes also offers differences and shows between the two artists. In Donatello, Holofernes is depicted is in a drunken stupor. You see how limp his body is. And actually, Judith is holding him upright by his hair. The implication here is that Judith is overcome and beheaded Holofernes through her feminine wiles and cunning, and the implication that thus casts Judith as much as a heroine as a temptress. This is not the case in the much more physical drama that is unfolding in Artemisia's work. This, where we see an act of Artemisia and Abra. In this instance, Artemisia's work is closer to that of Caravaggio's painting of this Judith beheading Holofernes. In fact, Artemisia's work, because of the many similarities, was first attributed to Caravaggio. Yet there are some major differences. Caravaggio's work is the outgrowth of naturalism in the 17th century that led to a new emphasis on depicting courage and physical prowess. And Artemisia's compositions share some of the theatricality of Caravaggio's Baroque style in terms of use of light and dark and vigorous naturalism, complete with gore, blood, and horror. Like Caravaggio, Artemisia's Judith is actively engaged in the assassination. But if we take a look at Caravaggio's, the expression on the face of Caravaggio's Judith, she appears, in fact, almost expressionless and almost strangely detached from what she is doing. Her slender body type appears incapable of swinging the sword that she holds. The major difference, and perhaps the most obvious, though, is in the figure of Abra, the maidservant. In Caravaggio's work, she is depicted as an old woman, perhaps a chaperone, as would have been necessary in the period of not just the Old Testament, but also when Caravaggio is painting. And she has a very passive role in the unfolding drama. Judith Abra, on the other hand, is young and vibrant, and is not passive or feeble. She is, in fact, an equal partner with the heroine, Judith, in forcibly restraining the struggling general, putting her weight behind it. Her knee is actually resting on his chest in order to hold him down, as he now has awakened. Judith is also pushing back with her straight arm, trying to hold Holofernes' head down as she slices his neck with her sword. The composition is a flurry of thrusting arms and is in a pinwheel device, forcefully conveys the ferocity of the scene as Holofernes struggles for his life, both women using force to subdue him. X-rays have revealed that the Artemisia actually experimented with the arrangement of the figures, making it even more of a flurry here in the center of the composition of arms and hands, and barely visible here in this particular work, the rest of Holofernes' body. X-rays have also shown that Artemisia's Judith had even a much fiercer look on her face, but that she smoothed that out in this particular version. Now we're back to looking at both the earlier version of this scene and the later version, which are almost identical, with the exception, of course, that the Judith is much more elegantly dressed, again in Artemisia gold, and she is much more bejeweled, especially, it's hard to see this here, this is a bracelet that she is holding here. The bracelet, interestingly enough, gives us an insight into the scholarship. It is believed that it was decorated with cameos or enamels of figures. Mary Gerard has interpreted these figures as the goddess Artemis, therefore referring to Artemisia's name. Ward Beazle, on the other hand, has taken the approach that they are images of Mars, goddess of war, and are an ironic comment on the reversals of roles that we're seeing in this particular composition. My take would be that it's clear they're not either, and we really can't tell what they are. And therefore, there really is more need for very specific and accurate information as scholars continue to look at Artemisia's work. It is not surprising that Artemisia would be wearing a much more finery in the later painting, which comes at the end of her period in Florence, in the Florentine court's interest in material richness. There have been several interpretations offered for this particular piece. Again, Mary Gerard notes that she sees this work as Artemisia's rejection of the traditional interpretation of the heroine as temptress, and that this interpretation was inspired, at least in part, by Artemisia's response to her rape by Tassi. Others have cautioned against an autobiographical approach, noting that reactions to trauma are often sublimated and rarely emerge consciously. I think the real importance of these two works is in the broader implications for art history. Artemisia began to develop in this time period images in her paintings of female figures, not just heroines, but also when we include Abra's role in the drama that's unfolding, a wider application to females in general, that challenge the core traditions of female representations. That is, the female energy directly and actively engaged. This is new, and like I said before, challenge core traditions of female representations and establishes a new theme in European art, the expression of female energy, courage, and resolve, which was alien to the prevailing artistic temperament. For the more than 7 or 8 years that Artemisia lived in Florence, she had juggled her duties as a professional artist, wife, and mother, and coped with the debts that both she and her husband had run up, and borne the strain of 4 pregnancies. In February 1620, she wrote to her patron Cosimo that she planned to take a short trip to Rome for a couple of months, where she hoped to recover from, and I quote, "my many past illnesses and a few troubles at home with family." Cosimo Due, her patron, died before her planned return, and because of his death or her debts still owed in Florence, Artemisia never returned. Instead, she remained in Florence, where her fame continued to grow, and eventually moved to Naples, Venice, and England, where she painted with her father for the king. Having taken refuge in Florence during the early period of her career, Artemisia rose to a new level of recognition during this period, accorded few artists, male or female. During her period under the Medici patronage, she grew both personally and a new level, as I've said, of literacy and education, and she began to explore new themes in Western art, expressing female energy in direct rather than arrested action, a new theme that emerged uniquely with her at this time period. What remains to be done is to discover all the other names of the women who are on Artemisia's plate. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea, for that talk. And if the audience has questions, that'd be great. But at this time, I'd also like to remind our radio and online audiences that you're listening to Andrea Husby's talk on Artemisia Gentilesi at the Commonwealth Club of California. So who would like to ask the first question?
At the end, you mentioned that she went to Naples. Was she part of the school of Naples that Hoya and others were influenced by?
I believe that she was quite influential in Naples. She stayed in Naples the longest of any other place in her career. And when she finished her commission in England, she returned to Naples. We believe, although we're not sure, that she did in fact die in Naples.
Next question.
I have to wait.
What sort of evidences do art historians look for in trying to date specific paintings?
Other than documentation or?
Well, there seems to be a range sometimes of 3 or 4 years. And what is that attributed?
So what are they looking for? Well, so aside from if a painting is dated on it or not, okay, what they would begin to look at are certain characteristics. So as I mentioned, it's this use of this gold that surfaces in Artemisia's Florentine period particularly. It's not there before she goes to Florence. We know that the Florentine court was very much interested in material richness. And so what we can say is that when we look at, if we compare these two paintings, for example, that art historians have, knowing this, can then say that this probably was done prior to this, where here she has been influenced by this Florentine taste, particularly in the dressing of her heroine in this particular. So it's certain formal characteristics that they begin looking at. It could also be degree of tenebrism, you know, contrast between light and dark, which either grows or lessens over a certain period of time. It could be the degree of naturalism, more pronounced naturalism in a specific composition. It's hard using these two because they're the exact same subject are handled very. It's clear that she's gone back to the earlier composition when beginning to think about a composition for her patron Cosimo Due. So it's a little bit different, a little bit more subtle than that. But I think that this particular dating actually revolves more around the dress than any formal characteristics like that, you know, and a little bit maybe the paint handling, which is richer and surer and that kind of thing.
Well, a few things. Firstly, the knife depicts the phallic symbol, obviously, and she had to have been raped to do something like this. But I would question if she ever saw Rembrandt's painting of Samson and Delilah. Because in that painting, which is at the National Gallery in London, Delilah is very much evident as a powerful woman. But there isn't this horror. And I think the horror is beautifully depicted. I particularly like the first painting. The second one I don't think has the power. But I think that it's so like. I wonder if she saw the Rembrandt, which was done much earlier than this. So it does make me it's a beautiful painting. Thank you so much for showing it to us. And I really like to know how much of the Neapolitan school came into her work, because I feel that too in these paintings.
Let me just, of the Neapolitan school, I have to say I'm not that familiar, so beyond, you know, just her general influence, I can't address. In terms of the Rembrandt, I would say that it's probably very, very unlikely that the young Artemisia would have had an opportunity to go outside of her home even accompanied with her father, to be able to look at these different works. The sources that she uses is a subject that comes up particularly in terms of that first painting that I showed you. Oops, Susanna and the Elders. Art historians have noted the similarity between the vertical composition in general, but specifically these two, the two elders, and this gesture of the silencing to a painting by Peter Paul Rubens that is in the Borghese Gallery and believed to have been painted in Rome while Artemisia was still living there as a young girl. And they also point here to this hand gesture as coming almost directly from the figure of Adam in Michelangelo's Expulsion from the Garden. The problem with these kinds of interpretations is that given social mores, she probably would not have been allowed to go to these different sites to study these works firsthand. That said, her father was an artist, and so if he brought back and gave her sketches, she could have incorporated those into her conception of the paint, of the composition. But again, remember, there's this debate that's going on about the degree of Orazio's in the degree of how much he painted this to begin with. So it's a tricky question, the idea of sources, and that's where dating is also comes in very important, because if you have a date of a few years and you want to say, oh well, she must have been looking at this source, if you're off by a couple of years and it wasn't painted yet, then you have to be a little careful. So
But you rarely get caught at that.
No, you rarely get caught.
I believe you said that she had a daughter that survived. Is that right?
She had two daughters that survived.
Do we know what became of them? Did they become artists as well?
She tried very hard to make both of her daughters artists, and neither one became an artist. We don't know what happened to them, you know, in history, but it is recorded that she did. Again, she is a woman who made her living through her paint brush, but she was not successful. She did think it was a good way for a woman to make her living, but she was not successful in trying to have either Francesco or Prudencia become.
It's the despair of all parents. Maybe they became lawyers.
Yeah.
Do we know where Artemisia is buried, and also where can we see the Holofernes painting in blue?
Yes. Well, we do not know where she is buried. In fact, we're not even sure the exact date of her death. The date that I gave you is the one, again, that most scholars in the field agree on, although that can go one or two years either way. So we don't know where she's buried. We believe, though, that she did die in Naples, as I said earlier. The painting of Artemisia, the blue, and the blue dress is in Naples. The Holofernes, yes. The slaying of Holofernes is, there we go. This is in Naples, and this is at the Uffizi.
Is that the Naples Museum?
I don't know. I just know that it's in Naples. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What was the subject matter of her correspondence with Galileo?
I haven't read that. I don't know. It's an odd relationship that developed between a young, fairly sheltered and untutored, and except for her art, young woman, and the best mind of his generation. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
I'm also familiar with the Judith in the blue dress. I had not seen the other. The thing that I'd like you to comment on is the distortion of the forearms, the massiveness of Judith's forearms, which is just so central in this painting, in both really, but especially in the blue for me.
Okay. What I want to remind you of is that when looking at this painting in particular, it is cut down. And so your experience of it, you see, it seems even more, you know, more immediate to you. And so I think that may be a little bit of what you're seeing as you look at these slides. In addressing her female figures, scholars frequently attribute her looking at, again, and this is dicey because we're not sure what she actually saw, Michelangelo's female figures, powerful women, but certainly not, you know, slight-figured women.
The other picture of this by the male painter, I'm sorry.
Caravaggio?
Caravaggio, mm-hmm. was a slight woman that...
Yes, yeah, and that was one of the major differences that I noted. Mm-hmm.
Do we have any idea how many paintings she actually produced in her lifetime?
I think I gave that figure. Let me see if I can find it again.
42 or something.
48. There are 48 now. Again, these are 48 that have been attributed to her now, but as scholarship continues, and there has been a lot of back and forth, some paintings have been attributed to Artemisia and then attributed to someone else. Others, like those attributed to either her father or Caravaggio, have been attributed to her. So it really is a changing picture that we see with Artemisia's work.
Artemisia painted the second Holofernes picture, I believe, in about 1620, and she lived until the 1650s. Did mm-hmm. she? Were there any other paintings in that 30-year period on the same theme that are well known?
Not on this particular episode from the story, but she did. She did address the Judith story in a different, completely.
I didn't mean that in particular. I meant the theme of female heroism.
Of female heroism,
right?
Well, I mean, again, the next is a picture that I did not include. She does address Judith as a female heroine in a completely different composition and different moment in the story, which is when Judith and Abra are fleeing the tent, have been discovered. Other than that, I you know, off the top of my head, I'm coming up zero.
So some of her paintings weren't specifically female.
Most of her paintings deal with female figures. Yes, most of her paintings are about female protagonists, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Does she continue with in her later work in England with the Caravaggesque tenebrism? Does that stay with her fairly consistently?
It does. It does, as does the naturalism of Caravaggio. I think she... now, the work in England is for a ceiling, and so using the fresco technique sort of tempers sort of that extreme Caravaggioism, tenebrism, light and dark, that you would get with an oil painting. And so you have to consider that. The Buonarroti painting that I mentioned that she did in the allegory of inclination does not have the same kind of extremes of dark and light. It is a fresco that we see in her oil painting. So sometimes the medium will temper that, but certainly the naturalism that we see here is evident throughout her work. Yeah.
Now we have time for one more question.
Yeah.
Do we have an idea of how she was perceived by her contemporary artists, and if she had any students during her lifetime?
As far as I know, she did not have any actual students. She was highly regarded by her contemporaries. Frequently, when artists would come to Rome, especially Rome, when she was in Rome, we have a couple of portraits that were done of her by visiting artists. So she was known throughout the art community as you know, the very accomplished and well and respected artist. Personally, her reputation suffered the rest of her life, and she was, you know, frequently called promiscuous and all kinds of other names. But to divorce the two, again, is difficult. But the perception at the time is that, you know, she was a promiscuous woman, but she was, on the other hand, acknowledged and respected for her craftsmanship and for her artistic ability.
Thanks again, Professor Husby, for that great presentation. And thanks to the audience, especially great questions. I thought it was really, really, it got into the heart of the details. And I also like to thank those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. I don't smash it so hard this morning.